Good morning to all of you. It is a pleasure to be here in Canoga Park. My wife and I were riding to services with Dick and Carol Berkey, and I was asking him where Canoga Park was. Now, that probably doesn't mean a whole lot to most of you, except for the fact that I grew up in Southern California. And it felt rather awkward saying, I grew up in Pasadena, had family in Sun Valley, and I don't know where Canoga Park is. So I said, give me some other names. Give me something I can go by. And as we began to talk about other communities, you realize as a youth, you live in a fairly narrow world. And you travel consistent, normal, habitual routes. And outside of that, you don't go too far. So it's nice, as I got the chance, my wife also, to drive out here, to just rubberneck as we went down the freeway and look at part of the area that we haven't seen before. It was very delightful to hear special music. I'm always delighted to see talented families, and between the special music and the United Church of God Canoga Park Chamber Orchestra, it was very, very pleasant. I'd like to talk to you in the time remaining this morning and afternoon, since we go past the noon hour for services here, about the principle of accepting personal responsibility. As I listened to Dr. Ward, I heard points made every so often that struck chords that were familiar to the thoughts that had been going through my mind in this particular message. Many times over the last few years, the words of the Battle Hymn of the Republic have crossed through my mind. At no particular time, sometimes just randomly during the day, thought comes along in the words that he is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat have run past my mind as a part of the thoughts of that particular morning, afternoon, or evening. As I look at the congregation assembled here and congregations that assemble in various parts of this nation and the world, I see people in the last few years who have had to take stock of their lives, of their beliefs, of their convictions, and of their priorities. Each of those a significant part of life to consider and to think about. And in going through all of those considerations, coming down to the bottom line, the sum total of it all, and making a decision on what they would do, how they would live, how they would conduct themselves, what they would be committed to, what they would stand for. You know, every single bit of that I've described is a part of accountability. One of the oldest teachings that I can remember. My family moved to Pasadena in 1957, our first time in California, and lived there, or I did, for the next 7 years. Other family members lived there longer, and some still do live here. But I remember, as a part of the World Tomorrow broadcast, as we listened to the Mexican stations from the Rocky Mountain states, after getting down here, hearing Mr. Armstrong as he spoke to the congregation at the Shakespeare Club, one of the themes, among many, that he would develop was the theme of the building of character being fundamental to our calling. That God has called us. He's called us to choices. He's called us to decision-making. He's called us, as it were, to those things on the one hand, those things on the other hand, and we, with the ability to make human choice, evaluating, examining, and determining which way we would go. And that the result of this process of thinking, determining, and deciding either built up and established and strengthened character, or by the wrong choices did just the opposite. Diminished, tore down, weakened character. Now, whether you talk about the building of character or whether you talk about personal accountability, they are both intermingled in the sense that it is through the character building process that we either become more substantial in our Christianity or we become less substantial. God talks about a day coming when He will literally sift. He talks about the threshing floor. He talks about winnowing out the grain from the chaff. And you know, it's a fair analogy, because you watch in the human life as people march along and they go through decisions and choices, the tougher the better. They become more substantial in their Christianity. They become more substantial in their character. The opposite simply creates, as it were, a spiritual lightweight. And any one of you who's ever seen a threshing floor on a high place, exposed to the winds, and you watch someone toss the grain in the air and the chaff simply float away on the breezes, you realize that what floats away has no substance. It has no weight. Or in that sense, it has no character. And so it simply drifts off the floor, and winnowing by winnowing by winnowing, eventually the farmer reaches the place where beneath his feet is the precious grain that he intends to harvest, to keep, and to take into his storehouse. Spiritually, the same thing happens to us. Coming home from the Feast of Tabernacles, those of us who are on the council, I think, are interested in listening to the reports that come from every site, an assessment of the people, an assessment of the ministry, and an assessment of the messages. It was fascinating to me as I listened to the reports that have come in from the Feast of Tabernacles that one of the reoccurring pieces of information was the assessment of the caliber, the quality, and the substance of both the messages given and the people attending. And it's fascinating when you watch people assess each other from different angles, the audience, the speakers, the audience. And both assessments spoke to the fact that here were people who showed, sometimes intangibly, but showed the qualities of greater substance, greater depth, greater conviction, greater stability. You can't help but realize that God is, as the words of the Battle Hymn of the Republic point out, going through that sifting process. And what is sifting out as the qualities to keep is being manifested in the character of the people and the character of those who are working with and shepherding those people. Personal accountability has from the beginning of time been one of man's hardest choices. By his very nature, by his very intrinsic nature, he doesn't want it. And yet it is by being put in the position of having to exercise it that God finds out who and what we are. You know, you hearken back to the beginning of time, Genesis chapter 3. It's a fascinating thing as God gives to man the essence of utopia. Places him in the garden. Says it's yours. Everything that you can see belongs to you except the one tree. Leave it alone. In Genesis chapter 3, God records the fact that man couldn't leave it alone. What is the most interesting is in the naivete of the life of Adam and Eve. And I know you can sit and think about it. None of us would ever come to a conclusion, no matter how much we talked or thought about it. But here were two people that were created full grown. You can't help but wonder what happens to a human being who comes into existence a full grown adult. You and I are the accumulation of our experiences. So it's what we went through at 5, 6, 7, 12, 13, 14, 19, 20, 21, all packaged together that made us who we are. Well, these people were full-grown adults. I don't know what all went on up here. But I know one thing. I know that their instincts were just as sharp as those of ours that were honed through years and years of living prior to adulthood. In Genesis chapter 3, and in verse 11, we see a tremendous illustration of pure, instinctive distaste for accountability. God begins to deal with man and woman. They had taken of the tree, and then they had hid themselves. And God called out to them and said, Where are you? Verse 10, so he said, I heard your voices in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree which I commanded that you should not eat? Now God, of course, didn't have any trouble putting two and two together and realized that where they were up here was the result of where they had been here and here. And he said, who told you you were naked? Did you eat of the tree that I told you you were not to eat of? It is interesting that Adam may have been created full grown, but he had the same exact instincts as all of us see from the time our children are 2 and 3 years old. Instinctively, he was doing this. The woman, and the beauty of it was, this is a very sophisticated level, because, to use the slang term, this is a double whammy. The woman you gave me, she gave me the fruit. I am the innocent bystander who is the victim of you and her. If she hadn't given me the fruit, I wouldn't have eaten it. And if you hadn't made her, then she wouldn't have been there to give me the fruit to eat. And now here I am, looking at the consequences that I have to reap that are her fault and your fault. Now that's pretty sophisticated avoidance of accountability, right from the start. But it is the nature that is inherent and intrinsic to human nature to say without thought, without premeditation, I don't want accountability for what I do or why I do it. Verse 13, the Lord said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman wasn't any less skilled than the man in this case. She said, the serpent gave it to me. By implication, the woman was as skilled at avoiding accountability as was the man. Neither one of them could look their maker in the face and say, I made a decision and it was wrong. Both of them said, somebody else made me do it. As God dealt with the very first family, you know, we use the term in regard to the presidency, but this was the real first family. This isn't someone who's lived in the White House in one of the generations preceding today or today. The real first family, Adam and Eve and their two sons, were the place where God taught man the fundamentals of accountability. All at one time, all in one place, God gave all of the fundamentals necessary from that time onward. You know, essentially, for 6,000 years, there isn't much that you can add to the lesson of accountability that wasn't in place within the first four chapters of Genesis. Take the account of Cain and Abel. I don't need to go through the story because you know the story well. Abel's sacrifice was acceptable. Cain's was not. Cain was unhappy that God was not willing to accept his sacrifice. Now, I won't get into psychology. I won't pretend to be a psychologist in this particular case. So that's neither here nor there. I don't have to get into psychological terminology. Don't have to pretend to be a psychologist. But it was interesting how Cain was very willing to take out his anger on his brother. It wasn't his brother's fault that God didn't accept his sacrifice. The brother's a bystander. His brother simply happened to put something before God that God was pleased with. He put something before God that God wasn't pleased with. In Cain's inability to deal with his own problem, he wanted to make misery for his brother. Doesn't make sense, and yet it's not foreign to any of us. Every single solitary one of us here can sit and close our eyes, and we can run through our minds multiple instances of life and life's experiences where we've seen that same thing. You can be the innocent bystander that walks into a store after a clerk has just had a cantankerous customer, and you're the one that's going to get the gruff responses. It wasn't your fault. You didn't do anything. You just happened to be the person who was convenient for them to snap at after they just had a hard time with someone else. It's the way life is. But when God sat down with Cain, after Cain was stewing and brewing and foaming about the fact that his sacrifice was not acceptable, God laid down a formula that has never changed. 6,000 years, no change. Look at the formula. Verse 3 of Genesis chapter 4, after introducing the fact that Adam and Eve had two sons, Cain and Abel, one was a keeper of animals and the other was a tiller of the ground, it said in verse 3, "In the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstlings of the flock and of the fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." Now God looked down on this situation, and God knew all the permutations that were possible. He realized that here was a man who was extremely angry at the fact that he'd been rejected, and that potentially this man could take his anger out on an innocent bystander, and that was his brother Abel. And so he went to him as a preventative measure. And the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? What Cain, let's sit down and talk. What is your problem? Why are you in this funk? Why is your bottom lip hanging down on your chin? Why has your countenance fallen?" Now, of course, I think we're aware of the fact that in many, many cases, we probably got a highly abbreviated account. It would have been nice to hear a little bit of the dialogue between Cain and God, if there was dialogue. Of course, all of us who've reared children realize sometimes when you have a child whose countenance has fallen to this particular point, there is no dialogue. Everything is silent. And you may have to do all the talking while they're in a state of extreme unhappiness. But here's what God said. Regardless of any dialogue between the two of them, this is what God said. And it has been a useful formula in man's relationship with God from the day that it was given throughout all time. He said, "If you do well," there's the nominative term. Cain, let's come back to square one. This is not about your sacrifice. It's not about your brother's sacrifice. It's not about whether I like him more or I like you more. It isn't about what tomorrow will be like. It's about this. You come back to square one. If you do well, will you not be accepted? You know, the most beautiful attribute of God is the fact that God does not hold any single mistake we make against us perpetually. You know, we go back to this character business. You have to make decisions. What do you prize in your life as far as the character you've built from decision making? If you can think of something, I would ask this question. The character that you prize in your life that's the result of decision making, is it the result of a decision that you made the first time? Or did you fall down, get back up, dust yourself off, go on down the road, stumble maybe again, fall down, pick yourself up, or stumble and have to catch yourself before you fell all the way? You know, most character built isn't built because the first time the challenge stares you in the face, you get it right. Abraham is called the father of the faithful. And yet twice, as he looked at the possibility of dying because he had an absolutely stunningly beautiful wife that by the conventions of that time would make a nice addition to some king's harem, he blew it both times. Both times, he by intent lied. He said, "She's my sister." which was half true, but the intent of saying it was by intention a lie. And that is, if you have to make a choice between killing me so she's a widow or taking her because she's not my wife, I'd rather, if I'm going to lose her, to go ahead and be able to continue to live myself. Abraham's whole reasoning was simple. If I'm going to lose her, I'd like to at least lose her and still be alive, rather than lose her and be dead. God said, if you do well, will you not be accepted? Always, always foremost is the fact that, look, what happened yesterday was yesterday. As you look at tomorrow, look at this. If you do what you know you should do, I'm here to accept you. I'm not a grudge holder. I'm not a grudge bearer. If you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you. Now, this is a personification. It's personifying sin as a being, as someone who is at the door, lurking, wanting to grab and hold on to you. So what he's saying is, look, understand these fundamentals. If you do well, I'll accept you. Forget the past. The past is past. But if you don't do well, sin, like an individual who wishes to hold you captive, is standing outside your door wanting to take possession of you. He said, don't let it. He said, you should rule over it. You know, and that verse is one of the most profound pieces of information about the formula of the acceptance of responsibility and accountability for our lives and our actions in all the Bible, given to the son of the first family. Sadly, the son didn't learn a thing from it. It's been there for our testimony, for our education, and for our learning ever since. Sadly, though, he didn't get it. As we all know, he went out and killed his brother. It's part of that insanity of life to where we take out on someone who has no accountability whatsoever for creating our situation, our grief. And we have seen that in human society, and we have seen that in human history. We have seen those who in road rage simply shoot anybody that they're angry with. We see people who walk into schools. We watch, it seemed a while back there was a spate of postal employees that in anger at a supervisor would go in and shoot anybody they could shoot. And you see this rage that simply says, I will take my rage out on anyone, irrespective of whether they are the cause. Well, this was a mentality that God was trying to help Cain rise above. And he said, the issue doesn't revolve around anyone on the sides. It's between me and you. And if me and you can work this out, then everything will go well from that particular point. God gave here the formula for success or failure. Now, I won't go through, I could walk you through much of Israel's history. It is interesting that Israel debated, and that's a hindsight observation, I'd have to say. The sense of things when you go back to Ezekiel chapter 18, I have to use that as the basis for making this statement. The sense is, as you read Ezekiel chapter 18, that people between the time of Cain and Abel and the writing of Ezekiel 18 had thought about and philosophized and meditated on and proposed different thoughts and ideas about this thing of accountability, to the place where God inspired the prophet Ezekiel to write literally an entire chapter going through every permutation you can go through so that people could understand a simple reality. I pay for what I do. You pay for what you do. I can't carry your load. You can't carry my load. Ezekiel 18 is interesting. It's 32 verses long. From the first word of the chapter all the way through the chapter, God is trying to make the same point. You ever sit down with your kids until you watch their eyes roll back in their head and indicate that, Mom or Dad, please. I get it. I hear you. I understood it. That's enough. You read Ezekiel 18, and you get that same feeling. You say, well, how many ways do you have to say it? I'm with you. But God, the tenor of Ezekiel 18 is such that God is saying, look, there is just simply no way, when you're through with this chapter, that I'm going to leave that much room for you not to understand what I'm trying to say. It begins by this statement. The word of the Lord came to me again, saying, what do you mean when you use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, now this was a proverb, and you know how proverbs are. Better yet, if you've spent any time in the Middle East or in a Middle Eastern culture, you realize that if you go back in time before any form of entertainment or media, no radio, no television, nothing. People entertained themselves by their conversation. They talked with one another. And rather than just sit and talk about, well, how was the weather, and how was your day, and how did your plowing go, and how is your crop coming along, we all like a little bit of entertainment. Puzzles, conundrums, riddles. You go back to the days of Samson, and you get a window into that culture as he sat down with some of the Philistines, and they traded riddles, and they'd scratch their heads. Well, proverbs do the same thing. So he said, there's a proverb that you talk about. And that proverb is, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. He said, I want to tell you something about your proverb. Now, you can't get any stronger words than as I live, or by myself, or I swear by myself. These are all forms of the highest form of oath. When God swears by himself, it is the most definite form of statement that can be made. And so the statement, as I live, it's an oath. Says the Lord God, you shall no longer use this proverb in Israel. He said, everybody belongs to me. The father, he's mine. Children, they're mine. Everybody belongs to me. The soul who sins shall die, but if a man is just and does what is lawful and right, if he's not eaten on the mountains, nor lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, nor defiled his neighbor's wife, nor approached a woman during her impurity, if he has not oppressed anyone, but has restored to the debtor his pledge, has robbed no one by violence. And he goes on to talk about the things that he ought not to do. He goes down to verse 9. If he's walked in my statutes and kept my judgments faithfully, he is just. He shall surely live, says the Lord God. All right, now that was the easy part. You do what you should do, and you're going to live. He says, now, what though if he begets? You know, here's a good man, and sadly, this good man produces an absolute ne'er-do-well as a son. And the son distinguishes himself in life by being an absolute disaster. I read this last week in the Seattle Times an entire page describing the profile and the background of the Unabomber. And there really wasn't anything in a familial sense that you could put your finger on that would have produced a man of that particular distorted perspective. They went through his brothers, they went through his parents, they went through his family background. Everything described about background we would label as sane, normal, healthy. And yet what was produced is pathetic. Well, that's what God says. He says, if this man, he's done everything he should, and he begets a robber. Not only a robber, he's a murderer. He's a shedder of blood. And he goes on to talk about these particular things. And when he's finished, he says, you know what? The father who lived the right way, I will honor for living the right way. The son who decided to go askew, the son will be responsible for what the son did. His blood is on his head. His father's blood is on his head. And there's not a commingling of responsibility here. Now, he goes on, and I won't go through the whole chapter, but if you go through the remainder of the chapter, every single verse of the remainder of the chapter is the creation of a different scenario. And each scenario was built to teach the same lesson. Each man will account to me for his conduct. The father will not give account for the waywardness of an adult son that has decided to go the wrong direction, and that son will not give account for his father. From that day forward, those who took seriously the writings of Ezekiel and the inspiration of those words from God at least had a benchmark that they could use. Prior to the establishment of that particular benchmark, though, we have some interesting cases that show just how compelled men are to refuse the accountability that God would place upon them. It is a fascinating thing in the study of human nature that in some cases human nature would rather die than accept responsibility and accountability for its own actions. If I use the word enjoy, you'll understand it in the sense of the study of a personality. I have enjoyed for many years the study of King Ahab. He is to me, among the personalities in the Old Testament, a most fascinating study in human nature, of simple, unvarnished rebellion against God. The man seems to be a very simple-minded man. He instinctively, like Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, makes his choices, and he doesn't have to think about it. But Ahab is a man who avoided himself to death. He's interesting in that he had an opportunity to do it right, and for a moment in time he did. He lusted after a man's property, and his wife, in conniving, set up a kangaroo court, had the man tried, convicted, and killed, so her husband could have a vineyard that belonged to a man named Naboth. And God was so incensed by this that he sent his prophet to meet Ahab as Ahab was inspecting his new piece of real estate. And Ahab was self-indicting by the words out of his very mouth. As he saw the prophet of God coming to him, the first words out of his mouth were, "Have you found me, O my enemy?" The prophet hadn't said a word, hadn't opened his mouth. You talk about guilt clear up to here. And when the prophet of God finished, the man realized that he was in serious trouble. In fact, he realized it so seriously that here was a moment in time where Ahab captured a glimpse of the right way, because he repented. And he repented to such a degree, he humbled himself to such a degree, that the curse upon him was rescinded. Sad thing about it is, in time, he forgot the lesson. Other challenges came along, and he had a chance to do it over again. And the great challenge came as he sat in the presence of the king of Judah. They were relatives by that point in time. And they were sitting down to confer, the king of Judah and the king of Israel, about an alliance so they could go to war against the king of Syria. The king of Judah was a man who, by principle and by background, had a certain respect for God. King of Israel, Ahab, we've already put him in his particular box by instincts. His instincts were clearly revealed when the prophet came to him in the vineyard of Naboth, and his response was, "Uh-oh, my enemy has found me." He didn't have any warm relationship with God or the ministry of God. As the king of Judah talked to Ahab, they discussed the logistics of their combined armies going against the king of Syria. He reached a place where a man who has some religious substance to him would come. He said, "You and I have talked about logistics. We've talked about numbers and distance and distribution and deployment. I think before we make a decision, we need to ask God what He thinks about all of this. Now, you know, for all of us, that's a sensible position. He said, "Do you have any prophets of God around here?" And Ahab's response was, "Yes, I've got one. His name is Micaiah. But I don't like him because he never says anything good about me." Now, you know, Ahab never stopped to ask, "Does he not say anything good about me because I don't do anything he can say good about?" That was a question Ahab didn't want to ask. I won't take you back through the story. The story is in 1 Kings chapter 21, and it spills over into chapter 22. And it's easier to tell the story, and it saves a little time to tell it rather than to read it to you. But it is such a beautiful and classic case of the study of human nature when it comes to the point of accepting accountability. This man killed himself by his unwillingness to accept accountability. Micaiah, and you can tell these two people have talked to each other many times. You get to the place you understand personalities. Micaiah, upon the request of the king, came into the court. And Micaiah, upon being asked what he thought about their going to battle against the king of Syria, said, "Oh, it's a fantastic idea. I am totally supportive of it. God will be with you. You'll smash the enemy, and everything will be great." And Ahab's instinctive response, now this is conditioning, is to look at Micaiah and he says, "How many times do I have to tell you not to lie to me?" Now I doubt that he'd ever had to tell Micaiah not to lie to him. But this was a case of, if you say something good about me, it's got to be a lie. And Micaiah said, "Okay, I have been having fun at your expense. And you caught me having fun at your expense. So let's get down to business. You're going to go up against the king of Syria, and you're going to get yourself killed." And Ahab turns to Jehoshaphat, and he says, "See what I told you? The man never says anything good about me." Now, you know, if it weren't so pathetic, and if it weren't true, it would make an excellent comedy routine. I mean, this is ridiculous. But here's a man who automatically says, "I don't talk to prophets of God because they don't say good things about me." He doesn't say, "I need to change my life so that something good could be said about me." He knows inherently from the very inside of himself, when the prophet says something good, it's got to be a lie because they don't have that kind of relationship. And then when the prophet looks him square in the eye and says, "Okay, we'll stop playing games here and I'll tell you exactly what the situation is," he goes right back to the self-justification and says to his friend and relative, "See what I told you? The man doesn't like me and he won't say anything good about me." The pathetic thing about it is he got in his chariot, went up against the king of Syria, and was hauled back as a corpse. Now,